Afternoon. Today is the 15th of the 10th, 2014. I'm going to interview Michael Sanders on his Working Hawke's Bay history. Now, Michael, we probably need, just to start this off, a few statistics and information about your family and those things.
I'm a Londoner. I was born in Crisis Week before the Second World War. Had a normal London suburban schooling. Father who went to war, of course. A younger brother, about 2 years younger than I. And we lived in an ordinary suburban house with my grandparents. Later on, we got a house of our own. And I went from the state junior schooling and won, I guess, the equivalent of a scholarship to one of London's private schools. And I was there for 8 years, finishing up with good A-levels, but not going on to university.
Did you play any sport?
Oh, yes. I was first 15 rugby for 2 or 3 years, house captain of sport, that sort of thing. Sport was quite important. And the other thing that was important from, I guess, when I was seven, I joined the Cubs at seven.
Yes.
Went through the Cubs a bit, then joined the Scouts, became a patrol leader, and later on, I guess after I'd left school, so in my early 20s, I was the leader of the Scout troop locally. You know, that was interesting. If you can get on with a load of boys, you can get along with a load of anybody
yes,
else, I guess.
It's good training, isn't it?
It's good training. Things happen like with another scouter, we put a load of boys on the River Thames to go canoeing.
Yes.
And they brought out a different shape canoe for us.
Yes.
And it was, the Red Indian style.
Yes.
And we said, this looks a bit odd. You know, will we be all right in this? Oh, you'll be all right. It's the boys' canoes that occasionally tip over.
Yes.
So those sort of things, you know, you just learn to get on with them.
Absolutely.
When I left school, as I was leaving school, it was a puzzle for the school to know what to do with me, I think. I didn't come from their typical background. Today, I would definitely have gone on to university.
Yes.
And the school would have made me go on to university, sort of thing.
Yes.
In those days, they weren't sure. And I'd recently been on an employment course in the building industry. So the building industry sounded interesting. My objective would have been to be the man who built the big buildings, not an engineer or anything like that, the man who managed it. And that's what I'd done on this course. But in order to start, I had to start as a quantity surveyor. Whilst after about a year, they sent me out on site and that sort of thing. Adding up and drawing were not my game. And so I packed that up. I'd had several short-term experiences of work. And I set out to find a full-time job. There was something called the Public School Employment Bureau or something. And I went to them, and they sent me to a couple of people. One, I think, was the big paper people, Beau Waters. And the guy said, oh, I said, I don't think you're going to settle down. You haven't settled down yet. It's too late. Then another one that came out of the thing was something called the Union International Company, which sounded interesting, international. And it was in central London, and they interviewed me and decided to give me a job. And I was then 22. I started as a sort of clerk for 6 months to learn the area. And then we were actually a selling and trading group in this part of the company. And I got put into the hides department. And we took the hides that were produced in New Zealand, Australia, South America, and sold them into Europe.
So was this your first association with New Zealand through the hides of our animals?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And it was the same company that owned Tomono, I found out much later on.
Oh, well, that's,
you know. That's how I got into the company.
Right.
And this would have been... I joined the company on Independence Day, July the 4th, of all things. I got married that October. And had our first child early the next year, or not too early, but in the next year.
Yes, sure.
And the system that they worked was that you became the boy in the selling team, did all the office records and this sort of thing, and occasionally got set loose to talk to somebody in Prague or Austria or Germany. Certainly. And you move from one area to another. So I did spell and hides, a spell and meat and bone mill, a spell selling things like canned fruit and goodness knows what else to places in like Hong Kong and Singapore.
Yes.
And then I was the boss, who'd been the boss of that department since the mid-30s, retired, I guess, about 62 or 3, something like that. And I was made number 2 in the department, so I became a real salesman in the department.
Right.
And the boss, who'd been a real name in the international hide industry, well-respected member of the, how do you call it, the panel that settled arguments and all this.
Yes,
so
yes.
The word's gone out of my head.
Yes.
So he was a member of the group that set these things up, and we actually worked with a proper contract. You know,
yes,
his number 2 came number 1, I became number 2, and at the same time I thought that I've got to be able to do more than this, and I started going to night school to do the early equivalent of an MBA.
Yes.
It was at the local technical college.
Sure.
Rather than university.
Yes.
But it was the start of what became
Simply.
MBAs. And as that went along, I did about 2 years of that, and I got into the third year, and I went to the boss of the whole of the trading organisation, which was a small company of the big company, as you can imagine, and said, look, I can't go on working behind my number 1. I've got to do more than that. And the reason for saying that, and I'm not sure this should be part of my recorded history, was that by this time we had to report to a director, and we'd now reached a stage where the director rang me up to ask what was going on, then hung up and rang my boss up to quiz him about an uncomfortable position that you don't want to be in.
Yes, yes I do.
And so I said, you know, find some job, and boss, who was a Welshman and was the leader of the sort of sales team, he said, oh, you seem to be able to get on with almost anybody, so perhaps we could send you to Australia. So I said, well, okay. And eventually I was taken up for an interview to the boss of Australia and New Zealand, and by this time I had a daughter as well. And he said, probably you would have been all right. But now you're married, we've never sent anybody out with 2 children at your sort of state. So I think, you know, it's not going to happen. A couple of months later, his predecessor, who was still a senior member of the company, came to our department, talked to the heads of each of the departments, and then he talked to me. Just a chat like we're having.
Sure.
Nothing more than that.
Yep.
Another month was went by, and I got a call to say, you've got to come up and work in the Australian New Zealand department. We are going to send you to Australia.
Well.
So in 1963 or 64, we were given the choice of coming by boat or flying, and we decided to fly. We came out to Australia. The English group of meatworks are in the Vestey group, same as the New Zealand companies here. And the way I explain it is by way of metaphor. I was given a knife and a broom and told, go and learn about a freezing quote.
Good on you.
And then I went from department to department, and I had to write a report on each department. And I think that was to take, well, that took about 8 months to go around one freezing quote. Lamb kill, sheep kill, beef kill, pig
sure.
kill, small goods, high byproducts departments. I was lucky at Christmas time I was in the small goods department, and they go mad at Christmas, you know, and very busy. We used to bring in people from the local RAF base who wanted to earn extra money, and they were a sort of flying gang who did all the packing jobs.
Sure, yeah.
I was given the job of running them, so started to learn how to do these things. And after 9 months or thereabouts, so the next autumn, I guess you'd say, I was transferred up to Townsville with my family, and the job there was to be in the production department. The people who estimated the amount of stock we would get, after somebody else had worked out the numbers, we worked it out in tonnages, and the tall of me got the orders, planned them in the works, planned the shipments, and that was sort of a training job, moving you from physical work and foremanship to a wider understanding.
Sure.
And I think I did more or less 2 years of that. We had a change of general managers, and I got on well with the new general manager, and he had to go back to a different works to be head for the holidays. In Townsville, we worked from Easter to October. It was too damn hot from October to Easter to work. And he left me in charge of communication on the plant, which was a bit odd, but that's what happened. As a result of that, I got transferred out to go to another works just down the road as an assistant works manager, which was a bit surprising to the works manager. He didn't think that I had anywhere near enough experience. And we had a fairly uneasy relationship for a year. And he went on holiday, as he was due to do in the summer, and he came back at the end fully convinced that the things would have gone wrong, the staff place would be untidy.
And it wasn't.
And it wasn't. The only thing that was untidy was the volume of spiders.
Yes.
But he'd been down in Melbourne, where there aren't many spiders, and we were in central Queensland, where there are a lot of spiders. And then, I mean, I guess my career was pretty lucky. There was reason in the company somewhere or other to move the man. We had 13 butcher shops in Rockhampton and a small goods factory. And that was a sort of general manager's job of a very small piece. The guy that they wanted to, had been running it, they wanted to take him down to New South Wales. But the man they had in mind to come and run it wasn't available until September, say. So there were 6 or 8 months of no general manager. So they said, go and be general manager of the butcher shops. And the butcher shops, it was just at the time when supermarkets were beginning to take on butchery. So these little butcher shops all around the town had been absolutely necessary, but now were becoming. And so I put together a plan to change it, but didn't get any chance to put that into operation, because they decided that it would be a good idea to take me back to London to help out in the meat marketing department, which looked after all the Australian, New Zealand market and the USA. So they sent me to New Zealand. I came to New Zealand, and the boss said, we want you to go around all the New Zealand works and see the way they kill lamb and beef. And I said, surely that's a waste of time. I just spent 3 years in Australia doing that. Oh, he said, yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. I tell you what, you stay here in Wellington and work for me, and I will give you projects and jobs to do. And so I became a guy who took problems to a works or took solutions to a works and liaised with the various management team. Because I was in Wellington working for the boss of New Zealand, I went to the industry meetings of what was the North Island Freezing Company Association and its South Island equivalent, SIFCA. In fact, I remember voting once in one of those things because the boss was ill, who didn't come. So, fortunately, I knew somebody on there who gave me the lead, which was the right vote.
Yes.
And so the idea was that we would do this. We'd go back to London, and we'd work in the Australia-New Zealand department for a year or two, probably with the idea of coming back again later. And we came up to Auckland for our last couple of weeks. Then we got a message from London that we've changed our mind. There's a new boss in London. He wants somebody much more experienced than you in that job. So we're going to send you back to Australia. So with a container full of goods on its way to England, with a wife and two children on their way to England, we went home for whatever it was, 2 to 3 months leave, which we were entitled to. We broke into the container and put the bikes for the kids the grandparents bought, and we went back to Australia. In Australia, I was to be in Sydney, and in Sydney I was given the job of doing the long service leave for the man who ran all the wholesale departments in Sydney, and then I was given the job of looking after the long service leave of the number two in Sydney. So now I've done, what, 3.5 years and another year, 4.5 years in Australia. I got called to head office and they said, we'd like to send you to Townsville as general manager. So when you accept it,
back to Townsville.
Back to Townsville. Oh. And the number two in Australia said, what do you think of what we've just done to you? So I said, well, it's a bit of a big jump, but you know, it's very complimentary. He said, do you think we've Peter principled you? And all I could say was, I hope not. And we went to Townsville, and Townsville is an interesting place to be. It's very hot, very seasonal. The works killed the best part of 50,000 head a year.
There's a cattle?
Cattle, no sheep.
No cattle.
And you could buy them at markets, just like you could here in New Zealand, but you could also go out to a property and buy 500 or 1,000 at a time.
Sure.
So that was that, and I did 2 years of that, and that was really very good. It was a small enough works to get round. It had its problems. The first meat inspection I had by the USDA, they came in, they'd been out there about 15-20 minutes, storming back, your works is off the list, you're not packing the meat properly, the meat that you are putting in the box for trimmings and that sort of thing is too small. It's not allowed. So, of course, I have to ring up the boss and ring up the MAF and get the MAF to ring up the MAF in Canberra. It was nothing to do with our plant. It was an argument that Australia was having with the USA of what the smallest identical size of meat could be. So we did 2 years at Townsville, and then they decided that the man who was number two in Melbourne, I guess you'd say, wasn't fitting as well as they wanted. So they decided to swap us, and he came up to take over Townsville, which was a much more... Melbourne was a lamb, beef, pig-killing plant, made small goods, had 30 butcher shops around the town, an offshoot in Wodonga that did something or other. So it was a much more complicated business. And I went down to do that. And we hadn't been going too long, and the boss wasn't all that easy to get on with, which is why the other guy had been pushed out. And one day we went up to Wodonga to visit some supermarkets. We got a chance to have a look at the brewery there, and they were canning pet food, they claimed, at the speed that Carlton breweries were canning beer in Melbourne.
Is that right?
A fantastic machine.
Yes.
Absolutely fantastic. And on the way back, he began to feel unwell, and we got back, and he had about a fortnight off, during which time the Americans did slap a ban on all meat going out of Australia. And it was in the middle of the Queensland season, and so the bosses in Sydney rung up and said, look, we've put 10 containers of meat on the road to Melbourne, because we don't know what else to do with it. Sell it. And somebody had the bright idea that you could sort of, have a pop-up shop, I suppose you'd say today. And we took the meat in boxes in there and whole cuts in there. And we were prepared to sell whole cuts or boxes straight off the truck. And it worked. We actually did the job they wanted to. And we were there. So we've been 2 years in Townsville. We were moved to Melbourne early in the year. Before the end of that year, we were told we were coming to Wellington, because the boss in Wellington needed somebody to help carry the load. So we were going to be assistant to the boss. And so we came, found a house and bought a house in Silverstream. And we'd been in Wellington about 9 months when they said, we're having a shift of general managers, and so-and-so is going to Melbourne, so-and-so is going to there. The boss of Tawana is going to Westfield in Auckland, and you're going to Tawana. So it's probably in 1975 I ended up here.
So that's your apprenticeship.
That's my apprenticeship.
Coming to Tawana. Yeah. Okay, well, now the real story starts, doesn't it?
Yeah. So
okay, that's really... But see, it's interesting, isn't it? The building
Yes.
You know, right, yeah. Michael, that's fascinating.
I mean, I think I suppose you'd say a lot of luck. But on the other hand, I made use of it.
And there's no such thing as luck. It's not all you. It's having an idea and actioning it.
Yeah. And because I'd been in those various places,
yes,
I'd really learned to deal with people.
Yes.
You know, as you can imagine, a guy out of Townsville has got lots of different ideas about way of life and relaxation.
Yes.
Than a guy out of Melbourne.
Oh, you know? Absolutely.
And, so we came here. By then, our son was probably a couple of years or 3 years up high school. Our daughter was in intermediate school. And so we got a house in Havelock North. She went to Havelock North. He came across to Caribou High
School. Yes, Hastings Caribou, yeah.
Despite all the moving, we never sort of thought of sending the kids to private school.
Sure.
We were preferred to have them at home and cope with the things that came along in our way. The meat industry was sort of in a fairly interesting situation, I think, in those days. The threat of the loss of the European access was just around the corner. Hygiene was getting harder and harder, pressure to get it right. The unions were not terribly happy with these sort of changes of the job of, you know, but we've always done it this way. You can't do it that way, and you've got to wash your hands as well.
Yes, that's right.
It was not terribly well received. And so those are the sort of problems that were there. And I started here and started grappling with the job. That was 75, say. A couple of years later, and this is where it gets hard to sort of put your history together.
Sure.
So one theme goes like this, that the pressure of this sort of hygiene and stuff meant that the old works at Tawana was just not good enough. And the opportunity for volume of stock increasing was there. And we decided to build a new mutton and lamb plant. And that was built and finished in May 79. And so that was the theme was part of the first things that I had to deal with. You had the works, and then you had, although the engineers had planned it all and this sort of thing, somebody has to cooperate what the engineers are doing with real life and with the ongoing plant that's there.
Yes.
And the other thing I think was that at Tawana, they hadn't quite reached the full appreciation of modern industrial problems. The local union was a local union, and although it had friends in the Auckland Meat Workers Union, it was still the Tawana Freezing Workers Union.
Yes.
Muldoon wanted to change the industrial laws in ways that I can't explain at the moment. And the sort of nub of that change would have made it very, very difficult for small unions to be able to live. So the Tawana Union joined up with the Auckland Union, and although they sort of maintained a certain amount of independence. Mm. It wasn't outright independence anymore. And so we had the pressure, to some extent, of the big city people coming down here. Not too badly, but it was there.
Sure.
Sometime around about that same date, I think, the pressure on wages and how to get more money as a union member meant that somebody, I think at Hillebys, hit upon the plan of running incentive schemes. And they put incentive schemes into Hillebys. They used a Dutch industrial engineering consultant to do it. He was a New Zealander, but a Dutchman. And it was quite successful in some ways, except that the stories that got back to us suggested that if you were over 50, you couldn't be fit enough to work in the hell of his boning room. And we didn't think that that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some work done by this Dutchman for a while, and on one or two schemes. And there was two reasons we didn't like it. One, the sort of relentless pressure for speed. And the other was that when something went wrong, we discovered what he'd taught us as the management wasn't enough to sort it out.
Sure.
It was still official in there that we had to call him in for. And we didn't like that. And we therefore went to, name we'll come back to in a minute, one of the New Zealand consulting, or one of the international consulting firms, and talked to them. And discovered that they were prepared to do it, and they were prepared to teach us how to do it ourselves. And this we decided was a pattern to go through. And at the same, I guess the other thing that's important in this is after I'd been at Tamono perhaps 1 year or maybe nearly two, we decided we really did need an up-to-date industrial manager.
Sure.
And we just did the usual process. And one young fella came who'd had experience in the building industry, which I knew from my history, and recognised that in many ways it's similar.
Yes.
You're different. We're breaking down, they're building up.
That's right.
But similar. And he was a smart young fella, and we decided to put him on, and he and I together sorted out the sort of climate we wanted on the works, the way we were prepared to treat people.
Yes.
Two things were that if we had rules that were absolute rules, they were absolute. Nobody could change them.
Sure, sure.
And if you broke an absolute rule, you got the sack.
Yes,
you can argue all you like.
Mm.
That's it. You know, and we tried to set up the system that did this. But also at the same time, we wanted to find ways of encouraging our people to do good work. And we found scheme, I can't remember the name, but there were several schemes going around in various industries at that time, which were aimed at making workers more understand that they were part of the system.
Sure.
And it's not only and workers actually didn't need teaching that. They knew they were part of the system.
Yes.
But management needed to teach, to be taught.
That's right.
That's the way you should teach, handle people.
Sure.
That if you tell somebody why they've got to wash their hands, they don't see it such a blooming nuisance as if you don't tell them why.
That's right.
And if you build up people's interest in the work. And we set out to do that in quite a big way. And so those two things went together, the industrial incentive plans, the change in the attitude of why people worked and how they worked. And I think we were very successful at that.
Sure.
And this is in the time, in these early years, this was beginning to build. We were building the new plant, and in May 1979, because of fitting in with international calendars and all sorts of things, we opened the new works. Unfortunately, it wasn't finished. We had a grand day, and there's pictures around here that you can find, but the works went on slowly being finished until early September. And around about the 10th of September, I would say, we put four or five lamb butchers into the new works and said, look, We're just going to run stock slowly through. Is this platform really at the right height? Can you reach the stair eyes? All that sort of stuff. And that was about the 10th of September. On Monday the 17th of September 1979, the plant went up in flames. And we lost all the productive capacity of the plant as a slaughtering plant. And so we said on that Monday, late in the evening, to the television, "Ah, yes, well, we'll have two chains going in the new works next Monday." And we did. But of course, it was pretty hectic.
I can imagine.
And again, I think that the way we'd handled incentives, the way we'd handled attitudes to work, and the other thing about the incentives, which I didn't mention and should have done, I said we wanted to know how to do it.
Yes.
But at the same time, we trained the union and the union leaders how to do it.
Mm. Mm.
The industrial manager and I had this sort of argument, discussion, and we decided that if you're going to have a discussion with somebody, have a discussion with somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
If you have a discussion about something that affects people, and they don't know what's happening, and you do.
That's right.
You never get anywhere because
the wall's up.
So this was, you know, an ongoing part of our industrial plan, and of course it helped us enormously in changing the way things worked. And we got the mutton going. Our livestock management team and some people from Wellington and so on had the job of going around and getting other meat industry people to help us cope with the beef coup.
Sure.
And actually, other companies were enormously generous at the time. Mm. Fokatu killed for us. Terry Goldstone, our livestock manager, was only telling me at lunch this week that there was a little plant down somewhere, I suppose, in the bottom of the Manawatu or somewhere, who gave us one day a week. I think they only killed 50 head in one day. But they gave us one day a week, which we could. So we had this organisation going to cope with that. And we set about building a new beef plant. And I think that took about another 2 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to get Tamana to work. We kept very good industry relations. We had by far the best industrial relations. Relationship in any big plant, North or South Island, to the extent that sometime or other we got the whole back page of the Dominion as a report on our industrial relations. I'm sure it's
but
possible.
The heading on that was Plant Sets Standard of Excellence.
Yeah. By then we had a different industrial manager than had started, but somebody we trained in-house, and he was very good. So, and then along, as these go along, there was the hassles of tightening American hygiene relationships and tightening European relationships and the attitude of our MAF to how this should be done and what you could do and what you couldn't. And in a way, that was the reason for the fire. We had old cold stores. The 1890 block was still going.
Yes, I know.
And we had to line everything with plastic,
hygienic
covering. And you couldn't just go and build a new cold store or new corridors. That would take too long and too much money. So we did what I suppose nearly everybody else in the industry was doing. We found this plastic. And we were lining various places. Some of it had been done and was successful, and hygiene was easier in those areas. And in that early September in 1979, we were lining the passages from the 1890 block up onto the slaughter floor. And something happened and set it afire. I don't think we ever found out whether it was faulty machinery, whether it was faulty plugs on the wall, or whether the guys have been careless and went out the way they put the heat to dry somewhere out. And I don't think we really, ever had a witch hunt to try and prove that. Because it was clearly not a repeatable accident.
Certainly.
And so we got on with the job and went forward. But the big hassle was by lining corridors and lining the ramps from one level to another. You didn't line at the level of the roof, you lined underneath. So you had a false ceiling.
Sure.
Start a fire, you've got a false ceiling, you start drafts. And this beautiful plastic was very hygienic, very good. Unfortunately, if you want to measure the fire rating of anything, you rate it by its heat, its speed of travel, and its smoke. Two of those ratings were out of 10 and one was out of 20. And this plastic was something like 8 or 9 and 14.
Good Lord.
So
you didn't have a chance.
You didn't have a chance. And we were enormously lucky that the fire started at around about 12:15, that sort of time, in a place like Hastings and a works like ours. Lots of people went home for lunch. So the first people off the chains and this sort of thing, and the first of the boning room closing down, they'd all gone. They'd gone to lunch.
Yes, sure.
That means that to get out of the building, there was only half the number of people that had to get out of the building.
That's right, yes.
And totally remarkably, there were no accidents in the fire.
Sure.
Except two. One of the firemen was going home for lunch, as we talked about, on his scooter.
Yes.
And he heard the bell, so he tried to turn around, fell off, broke a shoulder or something. And one of the fire safety officers, later on in the afternoon, suffered a minor heart attack.
Certainly.
But those were really the only two accidents.
Very lucky.
And so we were very lucky. My wife was told during the afternoon, there's a fire at Timona. She said, oh, Michael will ring me up and tell me. So around about 10 o'clock that night, I rang her up. And the film that you've now got of it is interesting to me, because it's got flames coming out of the top and smoke and that sort of thing.
We can see it from you can see it from everywhere.
Yeah. I didn't see all that much of it because I was underneath
it. Exactly.
Asbestos was dropping out of my head. You were trying to decide what to do with people. And I guess, you know, we talked about this good industrial relations in the report in the paper. The morning after the fire, when I got to work, probably 8:30 or something like that, the place was clean. All the roadways had been swept, and everything that could be made tidy had been made tidy.
Sure.
Nobody had organised it. Nobody had said it got to be done.
Sure.
It just gone done.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction to the freezing industry. Now I was a freezing industry manager. The company ran, and the whole New Zealand company had, you know, meetings between managers, and we're trying to swap. So I was involved in that. Not very much involved in industry work. That was head office job, so we weren't very much involved in that. We were expected as general managers of the local plant to play a part in the local civil society, so to speak. Became a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and you know, so that was important. Timona, I never so known nowadays whether to say Timona or Tomoana. I was brought up to say Timona.
We all say Timona still, don't worry.
The opening of the plant in September 1979, Tomoana was beginning to be mentioned around the place.
Yes.
And we had about 3,000 people came to the opening, and a lot were invited to come and listen to sort of official opening. The Governor General, Lord Westy, and of course the introducer, me.
Yes.
And all the front, right down in the middle of the front row was Tirukatni Sullivan.
Yes.
And so I get up and I say, I'm very pleased to welcome you all to Timona, and I'd like to introduce the Governor General and Lord Westy. By which time I noticed that Tirukatni Sullivan was slowly waving her head from side to side. I thought, oh, you know, I've done it wrong. So Keith Holyoake gets up and he says, I am delighted to be at Tomohana. So I became about that big. But actually, the afternoon went off very well.
Historically, you were correct, because none of us would have known where Tomohana was.
No. So it's interesting. I guess the other thing, we're sort of now 79, we're going to the early 80s. It's a matter of trying to run the plant efficiently, gain more efficiency, and improve the status of foremen so that they become more sort of foreman managers. When I first came to New Zealand, the stories of foremen said, I don't think we did it here, but in some plants, the foreman was the toughest guy on the chain. If he could beat everybody else at the back, he was a foreman. Yeah. I don't think Tomohana was as bad as that when I came here. Yeah. But the legend was still in the meat industry, and you know, we certainly wanted to put all that behind us. At about this time, the pressure came on for new freezing works. By this time, Richmond and Graham Lowe had joined up and were very successful with their small works here. They wanted to build a works at a Ringy, and Whakatū and ourselves didn't want that to happen. And the law at that time had all sorts of rules and regulations about the ability to build a works, and I can't pull out those sort of regulations anymore. But we were against it. Eventually, it was decided that it should go to a tribunal hearing. A man's name escapes me at the moment, but the general manager of the railways was made the chairman of that, and there were two assistants to him. And it was just like a court case. We had to present a case. And I led the company's case. And that was quite entertaining and interesting. Lots of late nights in Wellington as well as late nights up here. And it wasn't all that long after the fire. I mean, it may have been as the beef works was coming back on, I don't know. But those things were all mixed up together. So it was fairly hectic. And they involved lots of reading, lots of preparation, argument in front of the tribunal, which is an interesting business, being a witness in a serious case. You somehow got to stand up for yourself. Without being argumentative and pernickety, you've somehow got to set off what you want to say in a way that makes the people who you want to listen to it.
Yes, you've got to make your point clearly so they can't misunderstand what you said.
I know Mr. Thomas said to me one day that he thought I might be quite difficult to negotiate with. And I don't think that was true, but I was quite good at putting a point across, I think.
Certainly.
And so that was interesting. And we went along here until about 1982. And then they needed another change. They needed to rebuild Westfield.
Yes.
And the general manager was feeling that his basic history was an accountant, that he really didn't want to go on as the boss of such a difficult plant. And it was decided that by now I had the experience to go to Westfield.
Well.
So I was shoved off to Westfield.
So that was your exit from...
That was my exit from
Tomohana. Well, that's fascinating, isn't it? Because it's amazing, really. And that was 1980...
I was thinking... 1980...
How long were you in...
I must have been about 1985, I think. I was here about 12 years.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's interesting. My son served his time as an engineer at Tomohana.
Yeah.
And as a result, he's always said that they received the best training in the world.
Yeah.
He said nobody realised the multiple skills they were taught there. And he said over the years, I've heard him telling people, he said he could always hold his head high because there was nothing he couldn't do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's fascinating. And so you went to Westfield, and from Westfield...
I went to Westfield because the New Zealand flock and herd were growing.
Yes.
Largely, I mean, they were growing because the market was good. prices were not bad, I think.
Yes.
But we had this idea of supplementary minimum prices, and that had been part of the argument that eventually allowed places like a Ringy and Takapau to be built.
Sure.
And we'd argued all the way through that case that it was unrealistic, that you couldn't actually farm that many. And the as soon as the new government decided SNPs weren't going to last, there was no point in investing $50 million or $60 million in Westfield. We tried to keep it running, and it was it became obvious, I think, that it had to shut.
Yes.
And I was there for some of the negotiations of the closure, but not all of them.
Yes.
It was a much more difficult industrial situation because it was part of the big city.
Yes, certainly.
They rubbed shoulders with dissatisfied engineers and mechanics and all sorts of other unions.
Yes.
Had a much tougher union attitude.
Yes.
Some of the old unionists up there were really still old-fashioned.
So did you finish at Westfield? Or
no.
Did you go back to...
It was, I think when we were at Westfield, or it may have been just before we left Amona, we were invited to go to Brazil and run a meatworks in the middle of Brazil for the Vestas. But by then we were 50, and we'd been down here for 12 or 15 years, and we just didn't feel that we could change our life that much.
Yes.
We'd have had a big house with us, gardeners, servants, a social setup that went with the works, but it was just too big a change. It was too late in life for that. So we said no, and came back here and finished off either what was happening at Westfield or, and then they decided that they would like to keep me after all. And so they had some changes in Europe, and I was taken back to Europe to become the European manager.
Certainly.
The same as the Welsh guy I told you about.
Yes, that's right.
So I went back to do that job.
Oh, goodness me.
And that was a bit of a stretch because I learned Spanish at school and hadn't spoken a word of it in Australia or New Zealand.
Yes.
The nature of the job there was that if the phone rang, you listened to who was calling you, and if it was somebody from the German office, you were a German. And you talked the things about the war it affected Germany.
Yes.
If it was the people from Italy who rang, you were an Italian. I mean, other times you had to withdraw and be a bestie manager.
Yes.
But
yes.
You had to understand. I mean, there had just been hassles for New Zealand about some EEC regulation that we'd been paying tax.
Mm.
Then it was discovered that they'd been taking tax off of us they shouldn't do, and therefore we should get it back. Well, the Dutch and the Germans sent the money back. The Greeks and the Italians didn't. And they decided, and I guess, I'm not sure where I was, but I wasn't involved with the New Zealand end at all. They decided to send two or three of New Zealand's general managers over there or whatever on a mission to get it back. And one of them was one of these fiery new managers they found in the South Island. And they went to Greece and Italy. And in Italy, they went to see the biggest importer in Italy. And while they were talking to him, they said, "You've got to pay us back." And when I saw this guy a few months later, my Italian manager didn't want me to go and see him. She said, "You can't, you know, this is still too raw. You mustn't mention it, you mustn't talk about it." I said, "Look, I've just come from New Zealand, I'm the boss in Europe, for Italy."
Yes.
He knows that.
Yes.
I'm not going to talk to him about that, but I bet he talks to me.
I bet he does. Yes.
And he said, "You lot, you know, you come up here, you bang my desk, and you expect to get something out of me? No way." In any case, he said, the Italian tax system took most of that money off of me anyway, so there was no way. But we we didn't know how to deal with Europeans. Mm. And you need to. If you go to Greece, go to Italy to do business, you say, "Hi, Andreas, great to see you. Mm. How was your kid at the football on Saturday?"
Absolutely.
You know, when you've done all that, the guy in Athens said, "Never mention that we've got any meat to sell." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, if you mention we got meat to sell, they'll drop their price. Wait until they say, have you got any meat that we can get here in December? Then you can deal." On the other hand, if you go to Holland or Germany, you go in the office, you say, "Good day, how are you today? Let's talk about the latest shipment coming up from New Zealand." And you start the business, and at the end of the business, you can talk about other things.
My son was global sales director for a company called Maxium that used to work out of Holland. They were all of the distillers, the major ones in the world. And he had about 29 countries he used to operate to. And he had a person in his office who used to liven him up on how to deal with all the nationalities.
Yeah.
And he said, the Germans, the Dutch, he said, you couldn't believe that you had to handle them all quite differently.
Quite differently.
And he said, while he'd worked out of Australia and New Zealand before, he said, he didn't realise, but he said, this girl that worked for him was just so brilliant.
Yeah.
And he said, you're going to China or going to Japan, it was quite different.
Yeah.
You know, some you can press and some you wait. But anyway, Michael, coming back to Mona, as we knew it, when it closed, you were obviously in the company at the time. Was it a surprise when Timona closed?
Well, I think, you know, by then, the way the industry was changing, and it, also the pressures on global finance, I think it was a surprise to us and to the industry that the Vestas interest in New Zealand closed.
Because it had a modern beef field, and modern lamb, and it was a works that was performing.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the other thing, though, was that there was a lot of debt in the industry.
Certainly.
And one of the stories, which I can't vouch for, was that the bankers felt far safer at getting their debt paid out of the Vestas closure than out of some other closures they might have done.
Yes.
And there was there always is in New Zealand a sort of feeling, the way we do it our way is obviously better than having somebody from overseas do it.
Yeah.
And I think that my opinion is there was part of that.
Yes.
The Vestas at that time, or just after that time, no, before that time, had got into trouble in the UK because they had sort of set out to diversify, to have money in different areas than just meat and something. And I think they got into building property and they lost a lot of money, and that closed down one heck of a lot of further. But this stayed open until later.
Yes, when you look around New Zealand, there's a history of closed freezing works, you know, that just couldn't make it. Buying meat at levels they could not sell it for. But that's fascinating. Now, when you finished in Europe, much longer did you stay with?
Well, I guess I was about 60 when I finished in Europe.
Yes.
And I finished because of the closures that occurred out of that financial problem. And they offered me to retire in London, in England, or to come back here. And we'd only been in London 18 months, and I thought, I just don't know if I'll get a job in London. We still had a house in Auckland. The best bet is to come back where I'm known. I'm not sure that was a good choice in some ways for that particular problem at that particular time, rather than looking at the whole event
since. It's easy to look back in hindsight, isn't it? Yes.
When we got back here, I needed a job.
Yes.
Go to the consultants. Freezing works managers. They're always on strike. They don't know anything. I wanted a job with the printing operation down in Wairarapa. And the interviewer in the Auckland consultancy said, but you don't know anything about shift work, you haven't ever yet, you know, you don't know anything about fast moving machinery. And I said, well, freezing works works on shift work. We used to kill lambs at 60 an hour, 60 a minute. What are you talking about? But it wasn't enough to convince people. You know, the industry had such a bad name that it was very difficult to come from that side. Eventually, AFCO gave me a job, and that was very nice of them.
Yes.
But they were going through so many, so they made me redundant after about a year. And then they said, oh, we can't get on without you, we don't want to employ you, but could you come and do some work for us? And so for about 3 years I was a consultant, and they said, very fairly, I don't know whether it was official company policy or the guy I knew, said, don't forget the salary you had, the car you had, the holidays you had, put all that in the price. So I actually got very well paid for about 3 years. And I did some work first for the first time when I wasn't made redundant, until I was made redundant. I was in their sort of marketing operation in North America. Then when they took me back as a consultant, they had some other consultants from America who were looking at the whole of their shipping, and they didn't have people who could cope with this and so on. And there was a conference. Every year, or every so many years, there's a beef industry or meat industry conference around the world. I don't know how often they occur.
Sure.
Anyway, just before I got back to AFCO, there was one in Buenos Aires, and the new people who'd come from the dairy industry thought going to conferences was the thing to do. So they went there, and they came back utterly surprised that there was a big meat industry in South America that was very important, and they probably should know more about it.
So
they said to me, can you keep in touch with South America for us? Just ring them up and get some news. I said, well, I'll do my best. My Spanish is schoolboy Spanish that I haven't used for 50 years. And I hadn't bothered about language. I hadn't thought about that. And I went to the university to do night classes to try and improve my position. And so I was doing this liaison thing. At the same time, I think, the people who were doing their big shipping project wanted to know how all the meat flowed through the works. So I did a computer program. I made a model of the works, all of them, the volume of stock that went through. It's really interesting. I didn't know that I could make it work. I learned lots of formulas to go on spreadsheets. And so that was it. But one of the things we discovered was that Chile was the second biggest importer of chilled meat in the world.
Second biggest importer?
Of chilled meat in the world. Because Chile's a long, narrow country. It's got some cattle, but not enough to feed itself. So they bring meat over the mountains from Uruguay, Argentina, Paraguay, and southern Brazil. And that's the main meat that goes to supermarkets and all this sort of thing. And it's not far that it's got to come.
That's right.
So the answer is chilled meat. I think you could ring up and order your meat, and 3 weeks later it would be delivered. So that was sort of the lead time. But we said, well, we've got very good chilled meat, which we didn't have. Our hygiene standards were high and this sort of thing. We ought to be able to get into this thing. And then we sat down and we discovered that the return on Chilean chilled meat was going to be very good indeed. Because if you sell chilled meat from New Zealand to Japan or the USA, they want the best 3, 4, 5, 6 cuts.
Yes.
If you sell it to Chile, they want all the other cuts as well, almost. So you were selling 9 or 10 cuts, not 5 or 6. And of course, that makes a huge difference to the return. And I was given the task of trying to make this work. And we looked at it. We found out what the specifications were and this sort of thing. Then we had to find out about Chilean regulations. And Chile required that meat inspectors had been through a Chilean university. So we had to send a couple of meat inspectors to New Zealand to get this. We then discovered that all packaging had to have the label inside the packet. And then we sat down and sort of thought about what we were doing, and they were, I think probably we sent some samples. But we realised that if their meat was getting to them in 30 days, say, maximum 30 days, probably less, our meat couldn't get there in less than 60 or 65 days. And meat after 65 days in a vacuum-packed bag looks a bit different.
Yes, it does.
It's got a lot more juice in it.
That's right.
So we said, oh, well, the solution to that's easy. You just send it in a totally coloured package. The label had to be inside, so I go in a hole. Well, I designed this. I didn't actually design the packaging, but I designed that we had to do that. And got down the plan. And suddenly the AFCO works manager said, can't do that. Our butchers are too dumb. They'll never get the right label in the right packet. They'll never get it straight so it looks any good. I said, don't be so ridiculous. If we tell them what we're doing and where, why, we'll get there. I don't know about that. Anyway, it's your project. You'll have to go and get it fixed up in Fielding. So I go down to Fielding, tell the manager that I want a meeting with all the farmers and the packers. And I tell them about all this, and it's all going to be in coloured packing and so on. Everybody's ready and geared up. We do it. I go down there the first day, and people are doing the job all right. Suddenly the guys who pull the vacuum came and said, we're in trouble, boss. Now that you've got a completely covered pack, we can't see the bubbles anymore. Oh, I said, well, I'll go and ring the boffins at Mirren's and see what they can help us. You just keep packing, because it's only every now and then. So I come back, and they said, oh, it's all right. We discovered if you feel the pack, you know whether it's a bubble or not. We'll solve it. So that was the end of that.
Yes.
And everything went well. It got there, and about 3 months later, where the orders were going up, and they said, well, we'll have to go to another works. Well, that'll have to be Mariwa. Bloody Myra's up there, won't be able to do it. So I said, look, we'll do the same again. So I got to Mariwa, call a meeting, and I said, I come to talk about the Chilean meat, because we're going to want you to... Oh, they said, that's good. We've heard it's much more interesting than the ordinary packaging. We've been looking forward to you coming to do that.
Isn't it interesting that it's the wrong people that were making
decisions?
They can't do it.
Yeah. Well, probably this isn't something that should be recorded, but the AFCO management at that time, quite a lot of them have come out of the dairy industry, they dressed down to go on the freezing works. So they didn't go down in their suit. They dressed like this, or with a T-shirt, so that they fitted in. And one of the guys said to me one day, why do they do that? It's bloody insulting that they do that.
Yes, that's right.
I said, I don't know, because there I was with a tie and a jacket as usual.
Well, and so you retired in New Zealand, obviously.
We retired to New Zealand.
And
we did sort of 5 or 6 years in AFCO.
Consulting,
yes. Yeah, and I suppose round about 63 or 64, it was time to get out of AFCO. I tried some consulting.
63?
I mean, I was 63. Which, it was time to sort of get out of AFCO for me.
Yes.
I tried to do some consulting, but it just didn't fit my style.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
I want to work with a group of people and be involved with the work, not sit there and teach them what to do. And, I was saved because my son found a newspaper advertisement that said the University of Auckland wants a lay member for its ethics committee. And he said, you'll enjoy that. The committee will cover the whole works.
Yes.
There'll be lots of interesting stuff come up. I said, well, I don't know. All right, I'll try. And they put me on, and I joined the committee. 18 months later, the Deputy Vice-Chancellor came to see me and said, I know that some of them have been saying that you might be able to be the chair, but it would be totally unfair. You've never done any research, you haven't got a degree, and the committee often says to some professor or other or senior academic, you can't do it that way, it's not on. I said, I don't think it's going to worry me. I've dealt with union leaders and politicians. But nothing I could do about it. Anyway, 4 months later, he came back and said, we changed their mind. So I was chair of the committee for 6 years.
Well, that's wonderful.
And so that was great. And at the end of it, they made me a fellow of the university.
So you didn't have to go to university after all, did you? No. The reward was coming.
The reward was coming.
You took the hard road to get it.
But it was
that's interesting. Thank you, Michael, for that interview.